Hey, Fencing for Everything fans, it's Tom here to introduce today's episode. We were truly blessed to be joined by Amy Eisenstein in New York. We were putting our technology to the test to be joined by such an incredible guest. Amy, today on this episode, talks a lot about target setting and the importance of having realistic conversations around target setting. Her big bugbear is arbitrary targets that have been plucked out of thin air. And I think what Amy does today is break that down, explain why it's a challenge, and explain how you can combat that in your organization. We talked about everything from the coronavirus and its impact on fundraising to all the way down to how to challenge those conceptions in your leadership teams about that target setting challenge. Amy is a fundraising coach and professional fundraising consultant, and she's been in the sector for more than 20 years. She really is an expert in her field. She has always made it her primary mission to make nonprofit development simple. So when she talks about your development managers, you may want to translate that to your heads of fundraising or your directors of fundraising. But she's been around and giving away loads of free resources to help people master major gifts, capital fundraising, and she shares some of those resources in today's session. So do check out the links in the description for some of those free resources. And as always, get in touch with Amy or Andy and myself if you have any questions. Happy listening.
Hello, and welcome to Fixing Fundraising. Today, Tom and I are joined by Amy Eisenstein. Hello, Amy.
Hello.
We've obviously had a bit of chat before about the things that annoy you in the fundraising sector. But what we want to talk about today is just what annoys you the most.
Yeah, so I think what annoys me the most is when board members or senior executives set fundraising goals or have unrealistic expectations for their development directors. And that means that they're setting goals without any input from the fundraising team. And that annoys me to no end. So I thought I'd start out by talking about a couple of ways that, or the most frequent ways that nonprofits set their fundraising goals. And to me, they're the wrong ways. So they're the most frequent ways that nonprofits set their goals. The first is when a nonprofit has a hole in its budget, right? So revenue is less than anticipated expenses. And so let's say an organization expects that they're going to raise $100,000, but they have expenses of $200,000. And now there's a hole in the budget of $100,000. And so that is magically the fundraising goal, but it doesn't have anything to do with what the organization can actually raise. So that drives me crazy. The second way that organizations set their fundraising goals, I guess probably the most frequent way, is just a random percentage more than they raised last year. So like, okay, last year we raised $100,000. So this year we're going to raise 5% more than that. So, you know, I guess it's based on history, so it's not quite as egregious as like just setting a random goal of the hole in your budget. But seriously, like, did a donor tell you they were going to give you 5% more? How do you know you're not going to raise 5% less? Like, let's base this on some reality and some data. So that, I think that's my number one annoyance. So I think now we need to talk about how to set the goal and what realistic expectations for development directors should be. So in terms of setting your fundraising goal, it has to be based on data, based on the donors that you have in your donor database, and based on the activities and events that you're scheduling for the year. So what grants are you writing? What fundraising events are you having? And what donors are you going to be soliciting, both in person, by mail, over the phone? And using historical knowledge and some forward-looking, I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but for, what's that? forecasting, right? So good job. Thank you for my brain freeze just there. But basically, there are ways to calculate and estimate what you should and could be able to raise based on what activities you're doing and the donors you have in your database currently. And so that's the way to set a fundraising goal, as just a random percentage more than last year or whatever the big hole in your budget is. I mean, if you have a hole in your budget, maybe you can raise a lot more, maybe you can raise a lot less, but that doesn't have anything to do with what you can actually raise. So anyways, so that's, I think, probably what annoys me most about the sector is creating these unrealistic, wild expectations of development directors without any with any basis in reality. So the other thing that I want really to emphasize is that development directors should be judged also on some non-monetary metrics. So first and foremost, of course, they're going to be evaluated based on what they raise, but there also should be some non-monetary expectations that they should come up with together with their boss and the board. So some examples are getting thank you letters out within 48 hours, right? Can they do this? Can they not do this? That's a non-monetary metric that really will impact future fundraising if we're doing a good job stewarding our donors. So that's one. Calling all first-time donors to say thank you and to reach out and touch base and try and get them to be, you know, to be second-time donors. So that's another non-monetary metric that we can look at if they get to call on the phone all first-time donors. Another one, of course, an obvious one, is an increase in retention rates, right? So that is not tied directly to money, but are you keeping your donors? Are you increasing those retention rates? And, you know, speaking about something that annoys me in the sector, it's the number of development directors who don't know what their donor retention rates are still after we've been talking about it for 10 years, right? Okay, I've got two more for you. So non-monetary metrics. One is an increase in number of monthly donors. So, you know, let's say an organization have 100 donors who are donating monthly. And, you know, if you get it up to 120 or 150 or 200 monthly donors, so a percentage increase of monthly donors, and then an increase in the number of planned gift intentions or bequest intentions. So there's so many ways to evaluate your development director that's not just based on the dollars raised. So that's what I'd like to start off with.
Yeah, I think a really important point to pick up on there is that when you only measure money and you don't measure any non-financial, what you really run the risk of is people effectively burning bridges and taking shortcuts to raise the cash this year rather than building long-term relationships that's going to bear fruit year on year.
Yes, absolutely. And the reality is sometimes really good development directors don't hit their financial goals for all sorts of reasons that are out of their control. And so just to base it on that, I think is, you know, it's not a fair way to evaluate somebody to have it exclusively be based on the dollars raised.
You mentioned, Amy, that these are the most frequent pitfalls. What, like, I guess, why do you think we've got to this stage? Like, what is it a endemic cultural problem? Like, what are the kind of behaviors that have kind of led to this point, and why is it so difficult to get people to change?
So I think that, you know, as wonderful as the nonprofit sector is, only recently has the sector really started to be professionalized, if that's the right word. I think historically, the people that work in the nonprofit sector, including board members who volunteer in the nonprofit sector, are do-gooders at heart, which is amazing, but they haven't, you know, both staff and board members don't necessarily have the experience or expertise or professional skills that we need to run such a complicated sector dealing with the most complicated issues on the planet. And so I think that that is, you know, they're doing the best they can, but they just don't know, you know, they're making it up as they go. And so to implement some best practices and training is critical.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I guess to kind of follow on for that point, do you, of those metrics that you mentioned that are like non-financial, is there a hierarchy there for you? Like, are there some more valuable than others? And without naming names, or with naming names if you want to, is anyone kind of crushing that at the moment and setting those metrics in a really meaningful way?
Yeah, I think, you know, without naming names, probably, you know, the people that are really hitting it out of the park are the people that are making small changes in their habits and work behaviors and having small incremental successes. You know, I don't think that there's too many organizations that are just making changes and then, you know, smashing it out of the park, right? Or for lack of a better term. But I see hundreds of organizations that, you know, are able to focus on retention rates and what does that mean? And what does that mean for their daily practice? How do they change their habits, their work habits, you know, how many donors they're calling every day, how they're getting their thank yous and stewardship out? Just paying attention to attracting and retaining monthly donors is making a huge difference in the bottom line. I mean, I've seen some organizations where they double their annual revenue in a year. So that, I mean, to me, that is smashing it out of the park, right? You know, and once an organization tastes success in the area of major gifts and individual face-to-face solicitation, where they go and ask somebody for $5,000 or $10,000 or, you know, $25,000, and they have that initial success, then it boosts their confidence so much, and then they're able to do it again and again.
Yeah, one of the phrases that we use a lot of work is, if you take baby steps every day, in 2 months, you'll have taken a quantum leap.
Yeah.
And it's rather than try and change everything overnight. If you spend an hour thanking donors a day,
yes,
after a month, you've spent 20 hours thanking donors.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I say the same things, you know, looking at your statistics in just the most granular fashion. If you call one donor a day for every workday, I don't know how many days it is, it's about 250 calls a year. You know, if you double that, it's two calls a day, you've made 500 donor calls in a year. And so, yeah, I'm all about those very simple, easy to track metrics. Like, if you're going to start with major gift fundraising and you need to get out and meet with donors, you know, if you meet with one donor a month, that's only 12 meetings a year. You know, if you meet with two donors a month, it's 24 meetings a year. For many organizations that are not doing this well at all, those are sort of the numbers that they're looking at. So just trying to do some very, very simple numbers and for some simple math is going to significantly impact the results. You know, one of the things that we were also talking about earlier when we were sort of preparing for this conversation was talking about how lots of fundraisers in the field haven't had formal training. They haven't had, you know, formal training in fundraising. And what a difference some education and some best practices and really learning what to do makes. And so, you know, I think that every single development director should hire a coach a coach. So, you know, when we think about it, coaches have become so much more commonplace. Like 10, 20 years ago, coaches were just for elite athletes. But now there's coaching for everything. There's lifestyle coaching. There's fitness coaching. There's, you know, weight training coaching. There's weight loss coaching. And certainly business coaches. Every Fortune 500 person has a coach. But I think that if we could find, you know, one of the challenging things, I think, really for development directors, especially when they're doing individual giving and major gifts, one of the challenges is that in these understaffed, overworked offices, the development directors are responsible for all types of fundraising, including grant writing and event planning and marketing and direct mail and individual giving. And everything in their life is deadline driven. So the grant deadline's coming up, or the event is about to happen, or the direct mail piece needs to go out by, you know, the end of the year. And so major gifts and individual giving gets put on the back shelf because nobody's waiting for your call and nobody's pushing them forward. So a coach will give them the confidence, the tools, the know-how, and the accountability to really move that process forward. I think it would make a huge difference.
Yeah, totally. How would you go if there are any like fundraisers listening to this who are in that kind of situation where they are totally bought into the idea of a coach or a trainer or a mentor or what have you, but maybe their senior people aren't necessarily as bought into that idea as they see as an expenditure or whatever, like what are the kind of how would you encourage those people to speak up and have those conversations? What kind of things could they say?
Yeah. So, I mean, clearly when you're starting to negotiate for a new job, I think it's probably easier to talk about some of the things you want coming in. Now, maybe other people would argue back with me that they don't want to go into a job and admit that they need a coach. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's a bad suggestion. But certainly having a budget for some professional development, let's call it that. Let's call it professional development rather than coaching. And so I think that, you know, when you're at a job, well, first of all, so Adrian Sargent and I did a research project a few years ago, and we found hard evidence that fundraising training, participation in fundraising training, yielded about $37,000 of additional major gifts when somebody did a fundraising training. Now, I can't think of any fundraising training that costs more than about $5,000. So to say that any meaningful, now we're not talking about a 1-hour webinar, we're talking about, you know, a course or you know, something that's ongoing, a minimum of a full day training, but really a course that, you know, that you could take. And the resulting income was an additional $37,000 in gifts raised. You can't argue with those results.
Yeah, it's basically an investment is the way you argue it. If you argue in financial terms, you invest in me as a fundraiser, or you invest in our team, and here are our returns, I guess. ROI is your friend in that argument.
Yeah, exactly. So making the case for professional development and then showing what different kinds of strategies and tactics and best practices that you're going to implement as a result.
So following that theme, if we go back to the idea that there's a fundraiser listening to this who's just had their new budget set for them, and their manager has been like, yeah, we're going to raise 10% more, and we're also going to spend 10% less.
Yeah.
How do we do it here?
Yeah.
What would you equip them if they're going to do as you said and look at their database and predict what they're going to raise? How do they find that data? How do they use that data? What does that conversation look like?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I always laugh when people come to me and they say, okay, you know, my executive director, we're going to launch a capital campaign, and the board and the executive director expect me to raise, you know, 2, 5, or 10 times more than we're currently raising with no additional staff or resources, right? I mean, it's so absurd. It's insane.
Yeah.
So to scale it down just to an annual fund increase, I think, you know, the conversation is, listen, you know, we worked our butts off last year and we raised miraculously this much money. And so if we're going to raise more, we have to talk about what additional strategies, resources, what new tactics we're going to try, you know, and we have to have some room for errors. You know, we want to try new things in order to potentially raise more money. But if it doesn't work, if it fails, that has to be okay, too. And so I think having that conversation, like what additional systems or technology are we going to put in place? What additional staff resources? Or if we raise another $100,000 or $200,000, at what point do we get to hire another staff member? What are we working towards here? So I think that, you know, having that upfront conversation and an agreement that at some point you can't just keep upping the goal without adding new systems or technology or staff members.
Yeah, there's almost a lesson in there from like in the world of like almost capital investment, the way companies raise money through crowdfunding and they have to get investment from numerous people, but they build in those milestones. There's almost a lesson fundraisers can learn there of internalizing that, of saying like, we agree to your crazy targets, but here are our milestones. You know, when we unlock 10% growth, we get this, 100% growth, we get a puppy, like whatever it is, you build it into that conversation and you explain that there has to be hoops. If you're being forced to jump through hoops, you expect to be given a treat afterwards.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I also want to talk about, if we have time, you know, we have to acknowledge what's going on in the world today and how it's going to impact fundraising with the coronavirus, you know, traveling the world right now. And certainly the economy in major turmoil, this is going to have serious impacts and repercussions on fundraisers. And, you know, I think what I want to tell people is stay the course and work your plan, because what we saw during the last recession, at least in the United States, you know, more than 10 years ago, was that what happened was lots of organizations, you know, eliminated their fundraising budget and fired their fundraising staff in order to save money in the short term. And in the long term, those organizations did not recover. And the ones that actually invested in fundraising during that downturn and worked their plan and stuck to their guns and just sort of stayed the course, they actually raised more, even in the down economy. And so I just, you know, we can't be having this conversation this week, at least here, you know, I assume worldwide, but in the US, you know, it's all anybody's talking about is the coronavirus and how it's affecting the economy, right?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. It's a big challenge for everyone, but I think you're hitting the nail on the head there, is that often nonprofits can be a bit more knee-jerk in their reactions because they're worried about survival. I think that means you can get things a bit too close to the bone. And it's a big risk to all of our conferences and our training opportunities as well. Like that's a thing that people have in the back of their minds.
Yeah. So the good news is that there's more and more opportunities to use technology and to learn virtually. And so I would encourage people, I mean, just like this podcast here, but, you know, take advantage of all the online opportunities so that you don't have to venture out of your home or office, but you can still be learning.
Yeah. Self-isolation could be a very educational time for us all.
Yeah, I'll talk to a few weeks and I'll come back to you later.
Yeah.
I really hope that when we're through this storm, I really hope that like the virtual presence that we're building stays.
Yeah It could be a really great silver lining, couldn't it? If there's anything good that's going to come of it, it's unlocking that kind of virtual learning piece, because it's so valuable. And I think people, so it's kind of sad that it's taking something like this to put it at the forefront, but if that's what happens, then it's a great outcome.
Yeah. And also, while you're stuck at home, pick up the phone and call your donors. They're stuck at home too.
Because they're stuck at home too, right?
Yeah.
So they'll probably appreciate the call.
Exactly.
Okay. It's question time, Amy.
Just an alarm this time.
He did a weird jingle this time.
I'm ready.
I was stressed trying to panic come up with a jingle fast.
We have a new jingle every episode, and one day we're going to stick with one. The first question is there a a resource online, offline, a blog, a website, a book that you recommend that would help people kind of, I guess, tackle those problems that we've been talking about today? Like how do people, where do people go to learn about that stuff?
Yeah, there's so many great resources online now. There's endless blogs, but if I had to pick a few, can I pick a few?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So one, you know, I would start with AFP, the Association of Fundraising Professionals. I have to say, I learned so much from them when I was first getting started in this field. And I really think they have so many great contributors and online programs and live programs. So to me, there's no reason not to start there. I also love the Bloomerang blog, Bloomerang blog. You know, they're a donor CRM company, but they produce amazing content. So, you know, those two, if I'm allowed to plug my own, can I plug my own?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So I have two places that I blog and produce a lot of free materials. One is the Capital Campaign Toolkit website. So if you're thinking about doing a capital campaign, you're in a capital campaign, and you want a really new innovative ideas and ways to lead your own successful capital campaign with tons of support and best practices, head on over to the Capital Campaign Toolkit website. Also, of course, I have, my own website, which is amyeisenstein.com. And I have an online course for people who want to really learn to raise major gifts called Mastering Major Gifts. But I also have a ton of free material on my website. And I've been blogging for 10 years. So lots of great free resources there.
Excellent. That is good. That is a smorgasbord, as they say, of great content. So that's perfect. Thank you, Amy.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked earlier about anyone that we see smashing it out of the park in this area and about the steps and the changes that you need to make. What do you see as the first step people need to be taking?
Yeah, so I think the first step people need to be taking is making sure that in their budget is professional development training, whether it's webinars or going to a conference or hiring a coach. They need to be making sure that they're up to date on best practices and using technology and data to make sure that they're doing the most effective fundraising they can be at whatever level and space their organization is at. I would recommend always doing the successful things that you've done in the past, but then trying something new. Fundraising is all about experimentation to some degree, with, you know, educated experimentation, not sort of random wild guessing, but, yeah, you know, trying new things, trying new solicitations, talking to your donors in new and creative ways and outreach and stewardship. And so to me, it's about having the latitude and trying at least one new thing every year. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck in a rut doing the same old things. You're never going to be able to raise any more money if you just keep doing the same things that you do every year.
For sure.
Nice. If there was something you could unthink from the world of fundraising, Amy, your it were not, if it were, I wish no one had ever thought of that. What would it be and why?
I think that anything that an organization has to sell, that, you know, this sort of false fundraising. The other day I was in a board retreat. I was facilitating a board retreat. And one of the board members said, you know, they love this activity where they have to sell gift cards to random stores and then the organization gets 1 or 2% back. To me, that is the worst kind of fund. It's not fundraising. It's just promoting companies. And then the companies, out of their huge profits, you know, give a teeny tiny bit back. But all the board members and development directors' time and attention is going to sell these stupid things, whatever it is. I guess the one exception to that, I would say, is Girl Scout cookies. I don't know if you guys, do you have Girl Scout cookies over there? Is that a big thing?
they're a kind of mythical thing that we hear about in the States.
Yeah.
We've never tasted.
All right. I'll have to send you a box of Girl Scout cookies. But honestly, unless you have a literal army of Girl Scouts selling your things, which that works for them, that it's the only time I think you should sell anything. First of all, there's nothing philanthropic about it. Nobody's buying these gift cards because they want to be charitable. And so it's very transactional fundraising. Mm-hmm. And for the amount of effort you put in, you get so little in return. So I think that is what I would banish from the fundraising world, is the idea that selling things and the organization gets this teeny tiny minuscule return, and everybody, it takes all these volunteers and all this time and effort. It's nonsense.
So if we're unthinking this, do the Girl Scouts keep their cookies, or are they gone?
Yeah, no, I think the Girl Scouts can keep their cookies. That's my one exception to the rule. Well, it's because, yeah, we'll allow it. It's because they have an army of girls, literally an army, selling their cookies. But, you know, 99% of organizations that are trying to sell things have, you know, 10 volunteers doing it. They're it's a localized community. It's just, it's not worth it. The Girl Scout cookies, you know, they're so, okay, we'll keep them.
And they're cookies. You can't go wrong, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds like a good product. So.
Step one. The army of young girls. Step two.
That's so good. Love it.
Amy, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah.
If people have really engaged with what you've been saying, where can they find more of you?
Yeah, so the main place would be at my website, amyeisenstein.com. But if they want to email me, it's just Amy, A-M-Y, at Amy Eisenstein. My last name is EISENSTEIN.com. So Amy at amyeisenstein.com. I'd love to hear from them.
Awesome.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Amy. We'll make sure we'll put all the links in the description so people can get in touch with you and find your website and your resources as well. So thanks very much for your time. That was fun.
That would be awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Hopefully it was a good interview. Good enough.
It was definitely good enough.